Fashion Tech Applied is published. My co-authored book taking you through 6 chapters and covering the technologies and innovations powering the fashion industry. I'm Peter Jun Ho Sang, founder and CEO of Beyond Form, and welcome to the special podcast series Applied. Each episode, I'll be sitting down with incredible fashion tech professionals that are featured inside the book. On today's episode, I'm sitting down with Pauline Gisney, co-founder of Refact, a textile recycling solution based in France that can turn used garments back into usable textile fibers. So far on the Applied series, we've predominantly discussed software and digital solutions, but Refact is a 100% hardware technology that uses practically magic to break down existing textiles. In my conversation with Pauline, she rings alarm bells into how little the industry is doing to embrace circular tech like hers, and how the people with money don't seem to want to buy into it, even though necessary for the planet.
We were like, okay, we need to do better, because once we started with that first product and we realized how much the industry was damaging, we're like, okay, this first product is cool, we're making money out of it, but we need to do better. And it was a little bit of a case of, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? So what does it tell about us if we try to do nothing about it?
Let's get into the conversation with Pauline on this episode of Venturing Into Fashion Tech. How are you today, Pauline?
Hello, I'm good, thank you.
Good to hear. Looking forward to hearing your journey and how you created Refact. And obviously, you're featured in the book. I want to set the scene for our listeners before we get stuck into the conversation, though. The textile recycling market size is expected to reach $7.6 billion US by 2030, with a compound annual growth rate of 3.6% during the forecast period of 2022 to 2030, according to Straight Research. So it's quite slow in terms of growth, considering the size and the pace of the fashion industry. And I'm sure you're going to share us a little bit of insights and opinions as well as to why it's moving so slowly in terms of growth. There is a plethora of textile recycling solutions on the market. Many are not yet large, though, in terms of commercial scale due to long development lead times. But they're all trying to combat the current linear fashion system. And I know you're very passionate about this, Pauline, in the various conversations that we've had previously. Refact is featured in chapter 3 of the book, where we discuss material innovations and the supply chain. The space is exploding, which is exciting, but also very confusing for brands, especially for those brands that are a little bit more traditional in terms of fabric choices. So on that note, Pauline, let's start with your entrepreneurial journey. You don't come from fashion, you don't come from textiles, you're actually in corporate consulting to start off with. How did you start on your entrepreneurial adventure, and how did you make it happen for Refact?
Well, so I started about almost 10 years ago. It's been 9 years now, so almost 10 years ago. And I was in consulting in France. And what I did was, I always been passionate about fashion. So already when I was at school, we had to do an entrepreneurial project for a year, and it was a fashion project. So I was already thinking about fashion and entrepreneurship and everything. And I met my business partner, Sebastian, at the consulting firm. And we decided to start in duo, because that's our first company together. And we've changed business model quite a bit, because we started doing shirts resistant to stain and sweat. Quite quickly, the shirt worked. And the only problem we had was with distribution and sizing. So we decided, instead of selling the shirts, to sell the material that we developed for the shirts to other brands. So that was our first business model change. Then COVID happened, and so we started doing face masks, like a lot of brands at that time. And with that, we all the time we had the first product launched, we tried to launch other projects to try to minimize the impact of fashion on the world. So we had different R&D projects that we had launched already prior to COVID. And one of them was a recycling project, and it showed a lot of promises. And as 2019, beginning of 2020, when COVID hit, so we did the face masks. And from that, we had a bit of money that we decided to invest all in the recycling project. So it's been over 3 years now. We've started to develop that recycling technology.
You did a little fashion project in your younger days, but like corporate consulting is so different to the startup world. I know that you said previously that you've had many learnings and you made many mistakes previously. Like, what put you in that mindset to go from corporate to entrepreneurial life?
I mean, to be fair, so I told my parents I wanted to be an entrepreneur when I was 12. And I said to them, okay, this is like the best way to do that is to attend business school in France. And I had my eyes set on that business school called EM Lyon that was specializing in entrepreneurship. So I told them at 12, I was like, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and this is the school I'm going to attend. And I did exactly that. But obviously, when I was at the point of graduating, a lot like American citizens, I had student debts, right? So I had no money, student debts, no corporate experience at all. And my father is disabled. My mother is a teacher. So I didn't even have that experience through my parents' job of the corporate world. Like I knew nothing about it. So I thought, you know what? Going to consulting would be a good way to make money and also to approach different problematics of the corporate world and try to kind of get to know how a company works, right? Before I create my own. So for me, it was never about staying in the corporate world. It was always a stepping stone. But then when you're in it, it's so comfortable, right? That you start to question. Am I going to really be an entrepreneur? Because you're doing consulting. You have a great pay. You have very smart colleagues that teach you a lot. You change what you're working on every 3 to 9 months maximum. So you see a wide variety of companies and problems that you need to solve. And it's absolutely fascinating. So for a second there, I questioned whether I was going to stay in the corporate world or actually achieve my dream and become an entrepreneur. And it required a lot of sacrifices. And it has required a lot of sacrifices for the past 10 years still.
I can just imagine 12-year-old Pauline saying, I want to start my own business. I think at 12 years old, I wasn't even thinking about what I'm going to do in the future. So that's very forward thinking of you, I guess. And I think for context of our listeners that aren't from France, I've never been to France, you know, starting your business is not necessarily the number one agenda, shall we say, especially back in those days.
No, yeah, the French mindset is not as entrepreneurial as other cultures, for sure. And it is a bit of the administrative system can be a little bit heavy. And it can be hard to navigate to create a company. And for me, the 12-year-old thing started actually. So when I mentioned my father was disabled, so he started to be ill when I was about 6 years old. And so at 8, I had like a huge existential crisis. Like it's way too early to have an existential crisis at 8 years old, I know. But I was like, okay, so my parents are going to die. Then I realized I'm going to die too eventually. And then I was like, okay, so when people die, what happens? And I was like, okay, so maybe they go to heavens or whatever. But what happens to those who stay on Earth? Like, what's the impact on them? And I was like, okay, maybe your children are going to remember you or your grandchildren are going to remember you. But then after that, like, you just fall into oblivion, right? So what's the meaning of life? If you just suffer and then you die, why are we here? And then at 8 years old, I remember thinking around that time, I don't want to end my life just now, right? So I was like, okay, so what do I do with my life? And there was this TV program back then on TV, right before the news, the evening news, that was about inventors, people who had invented something and they were presenting it. And it went from silly, pedal cars are curved, how do you call that, curved cutlery to get some Nutella, up to very advanced things like water motors or whatever. And I was fascinated by that. I was like, okay, if I create something that it's, then it survives me, then I put something out in the world for others to use and enjoy. And I love that idea. So at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to be an inventor, right? I had never heard about entrepreneurship. I had never, as I said, I was not familiar with the corporate world due to my family history. Like my grandparents, all four of them were farmers. So I had like farmers, teachers, policemen in my entourage, but nothing about like corporate world. And then I realized I'm not there. Like you have to kind of be an engineer to become an inventor. And it was not something I was contemplating. And then I was like, oh, what if you create a company and then you have employees and with the wage that you pay them, they can make their family leave. And then it's not just about you and your family, but you're impacting other families and like improving the life for other people as well. So that really at 12-year-old, that was what entrepreneurship was for me. It was the idea to create something, an organization, a system that allows other people to take wages, so money from that, and have a decent living for their families. It's great. And it obviously now is to talk about the startup nation in France and everything. So obviously entrepreneurship has a whole different meaning, but I'm talking 23 years ago, because I'm 35 going on 36. So clearly back then it was not popular at all.
But luckily you stuck with it. You stuck with this curiosity to create, break things, invent things, which brings me on to my next question then. What is ReFact that you've invented?
Yeah, so ReFact is a recycling process for textiles. And the very cool thing is we're able to recycle multicolor, multi-composition textiles that are used textiles, because a lot of people don't know that, but you have pre-customer textiles that are production scraps, and then you have post-customer textiles that are your clothing, bed sheets, towels, whatever. And it's much more complicated to recycle the latter. So this is what we're focusing on right now. And we managed to take those used textiles and create absolutely new fibers with them that can be used to create, again, other clothing or other articles of textile.
You talk about the taking apart clothing, but it's pretty difficult to take clothing apart, especially within fashion, where designers aren't necessarily designing with that mindset that eventually the garments need to be pulled apart for recycling. So how does that whole process work? Like, what magic are you using to make this happen?
So actually the taking things apart is the easy part for it. So basically you have different recycling techniques, and usually they allow you to recycle one type of textile. For example, they're going to be able to recycle cotton or polyester, or in the best case, polycotton, like a mix of cotton and polyester. But it's always like one type of textile. And usually for mechanical recycling, it can also be one color, right? And our approach was like, okay, you have some textile that maybe you can sort, but a lot of them you cannot sort. So we're going to take a complement, like something that is a complementary approach of what about what we can't sort? And then what we can't sort, we just take and grind down to powder, and then we chemically sort them. So what we're doing basically is we're taking, if I go into a bit more detail, we're taking your clothes, then we're kind of shredding it into smaller pieces. Then we try to isolate the accessories, so buttons, zippers, whatever was not textile. So we have different ways of doing that, like with airflows or with magnets to capture the metallic parts. And then once we get that, the textile with a lot of accessories taken out, then we can just grind it into powder. So we get a multi-composition, multicolored powder. Then we take out the dyes, we remove the colors. So we get like a white powder, not like cocaine, a lot more fluffy than that.
No, not cocaine at all.
But when we talk white powder, sometimes it's what people think about. So very fluffy white powder. And then with that white powder, we have different chemical steps to isolate the cellulose, So the cellulose is the main component for cotton, linen, viscose as well, all the, those types of materials. And then we also isolate the polyester. And then the remaining, which is thankfully very, very minor, because the polyester and cellulosic fibers are 80% of the fibers on the market. The rest is 20%. And when we take the waste, we try to take waste that is going to have less of the others. So, for example, we're going to take trousers, shirts, towel, bed sheets, but we're going to try to stay away from coats and underwear, bra especially, and pullovers that are mainly made of wool, right? So the rest we discard. We can't do anything with that, but at least there are those two materials, primary materials that we can recycle.
So for listeners that are trying to make sense of this magic sauce that Pauline has described, she is featured in chapter 3 of the book Fashion Tech Applied. If you're looking at a short here, that is refact, basically, and some imagery there. It looks really good in print, Pauline, so you'll be getting your copy very, very soon. In the book, just quoting you, you state that less than 1% of any used textile, whether it's a garment or not, is recycled into usable textile. That's an alarming number. It's such a small number, considering how many clothes there are in the world, and obviously beyond clothes as well from a textile perspective. Why is that, and what should the fashion industry be doing to tackle such a mammoth issue?
So you have two types of recycling. We have what we call closed loops recycling. So it's textile that becomes textile again, and that's less than 1%. And then you have open loop recycling. So for example, if you take textile and you make construction material with it, like isolation material for walls and stuff. So it is a bit better with the open loop textile, but it's still very minor, because at the end of the day, so we were struggling to calculate the number, and then the European Union came up with an official number. 87% of used textile ends up incinerated or landfilled. So that's almost 9 out of 10. 9 out of 10 garments are going to end up, well, and it's in weight, so it could be even worse, are going to end up landfilled or incinerated. And so, and less than 1% are going to be textile again. So it's absolutely mind-blowing and crushing. I think there are different reasons for why it's not better. First of all, up until that point, it's been, I mean, we see it with some apps like Shein and other companies like that. Textile can be quite cheap. And so it's about, are the consumers and the brands willing to pay more? Because recycling is not going to be that cheap. So sometimes when producing new is less costly than producing recycled, it doesn't encourage recycling, right? But I think we're now at this point that people see the value of changing their habits and trying to make better choices for themselves and for the planet. So I think we see an opening. The market's been changing for the past 5-10 years. There is another factor that is the regulations. So now in France, you have a new law called AGEC law, compelling brands to include recycled materials in their collections. And they're both encouraging it through subsidies and also being coercive about it with progressive numbers of recycled material that they have to integrate year after year. So yeah, you have a will from the end customer, from brands, from governments to make it happen. So it's starting to emerge. And obviously it's, as we said before, it's a very complex thing to do, because you have, so the three problems with textile recycling are real simple. And I mentioned it before, it's multi-composition, multicolor, and accessories. Those are the three problems. And so because it was not a simple thing to solve, and it was not profitable before, then nobody did it. But now everybody's starting to take a look at it, and hopefully we see more and more technologies emerge in the coming years.
How did you feel, Pauline, when you found out almost like this dirty secret about the fashion industry as a newcomer to the vertical? What would 8-year-old philosophical Pauline be saying right now?
Honestly, I was appalled. I was really sad, really, really sad, because I thought, I never imagined that 9 out of 10 pieces of clothing were incinerated at landfill, and especially where it's landfill and how it impacts certain low-income country. I find this even more disgusting, that we take some countries to be our trash bin. And I really feel that it emphasizes inequality among men on this planet. So yeah, I was appalled. And this is one of the reasons why when we launched our first product, Resistant to Stain and Sweat, that already had an environmental component to it, we were like, okay, we need to do better. Because once we started with that first product, and we realized being in the industry how much the industry was damaging for the environment, we're like, okay, this first product is cool, we're making money out of it, but we need to do better. And it was a little bit of a case of, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? Because we had, for our first product, we had built a textile laboratory. So we were like, okay, now we have the lab, we have the resources, we have the money. So we have no excuse. And we know what's happening now. We didn't know before, but we know what's happening now. So what does it tell about us if we try to do nothing about it?
I completely agree, Pauline. And I think the fact that, you know, earlier in the introduction, I said that the growth rate of these types of solution is actually quite slow. It's only 3.6%. You mentioned there that obviously things are changing, but it doesn't seem to be that quickly, actually. And we find that many fashion brands, they say it's important, but it's not important enough necessarily to move quicker.
Yeah, and we've seen it because, so right now we have the technology we have. So for Refact, our advancement level, let's say, so we have developed the technology in the lab. We have built a full production chain in the lab. We're able to make a few kilos of fibers. We have filed the different patents on our technology. And we're now at the point that we're trying to set up a factory, a demo factory, right? To be able to make about 300 tons a year. So we're at this very stage of industrializing our solution. And for that, we need money. And we've been trying to raise money for the past 6 months. And so far, it has proven really challenging. And we have not raised that money. And when we go and to talk to brands, and I understand we're making fibers. So we're a bit further away on the production chain than what they're used to. They're used to buying garments or fabrics. And we're a bit more up the value chain. But they are the one with the power and the money to make it happen. And they don't necessarily invest. You have few exceptions, and namely H&M, who's investing in some textile startups, recycling textile startups. But apart from that, most of the other brands are not yet there. And it's been challenging because the traditional VC funds are not necessarily keen on textile because historically it's not been performing the best, especially in Europe. It's really challenging to find funds to industrialize this process.
I can just imagine how frustrating that is for you because the innovation is there. The tech is ready. You know how much potential impact it's going to have, not just on the industry, but the world at large as well. And people are saying to you, but we're still going to prioritize making an ROI for our LPs on a 10 times return rate or whatever it is they're trying to promise. And I think, as you say, it is sad. And I think for fashion as well, many professionals don't understand what that means as well. And quite often they are turning a blind eye away to it, I would say. I think out of all the technologies that we do feature inside the book, Refact has probably got the longest lead time out of all the tech because it's hard tech as well. In terms of lead times, we know we've had conversations about this previously. It can take up to 10 years for it to be commercially ready and scalable. In the book, we do actually say it took you 2 years worth of R&D and 150,000 euros of your own money, which is now actually a wrong stat, apparently, and it's taking a lot longer and a lot more money. Why does it take so long?
Yeah, actually, so the number and the timing is correct, but that was for our first product. So for Refact, we're at 1.5 million, so 10 times more than this. And the overall process up to having the patents and everything has taken us almost 3 years. But yeah, it completely, it's extremely frustrating. And especially like even for brands, if they cannot invest, we're trying to rally brands to sign support letters, right? Because some of the private funds we're talking, I'm sorry, I keep referring to them as private funds, but PVC funds that we're talking to, they're like, oh, but we prove to us that there's a market. And like, this is obvious to us being in the industry, but not to them. And even like signing letters of support or pre-sale contracts that are non-binding for them. It's binding for us to deliver to them in priority, but not to them. They can say, oh, in 3-4 years time, once you have the factory, then if it doesn't fit the market at that time, we can totally get out of this contract. And even that has been proving extremely challenging. I have brands I had meetings with in April or May last year, and they still haven't signed anything. And some of them promised we would get a signature by January 15th. And it still hasn't happened. So even that, as simple as that, we're not asking money. We're just asking them to make a signature. But there's always something that is more of a priority to them. The next collection, the sales for the sales period and everything. And I can understand that. And I can understand that for brands, the last years have been really challenging with COVID and then inflation, and that they're struggling. I can understand that they're reducing their workforce and that the people remaining in those companies are absolutely overwhelmed with the amount of workload that they're dealing with. I can totally understand that. But at the same time, what does it say about us as an industry, right? That we're never prioritizing these projects that are supposed to be our future.
For any listeners out there, I guess, or brands that are listening, then I think it's a case of get off your bum, shall we say, and do some action. And as you say there, ultimately, this industry and for the world, ultimately, there's going to be an end to it because we only have so many resources that are possible, shall we say. So we interviewed you at the end of 2022 for the book. So around 14 months have now passed. Can you share any insights and numbers that have come to fruition within that time frame?
Well, I mentioned that we are able in the lab to do a few kilos of material. For some of the steps for our recycling process, we've started to do some tests on 200 kilos. So we're really, even though we haven't raised the money to build a full-size factory yet, we're still advancing on that front, trying to up the quantities progressively so we can start. It would be really cool to be able to start a test launch with a brand. So that's what we're trying to achieve now. We also have got a lot of subsidies from the French and the European governments. And especially we have 2 million that have been allocated to us that we have not yet spent. So this is really exciting. We feel that once we get some money from private investors, we're all set, ready to go because we have already that money from the subsidies that was granted to us. So that's the positives, by the way. We were surprised by the reaction of brands and VC funds not being more excited, not making it a priority. But we were really surprised, on the other hand, by the amount of subsidies and help that we were getting from the French government, especially. So it's not yet a priority for the private sector, but it's definitely a priority for the public sector, which we were really, really pleased about.
And I think on that note, you know, for many Western brands, it's not needed to go to, you know, China or India to see this type of machinery in action is literally on their doorsteps. So going back to our earlier point of, you know, getting off your bum and doing something, I think the very first thing is to go and see what are the possibilities. So I want to actually change my last question to something a little bit differently than I normally do on my interviews. I want to hear your rally cry, I guess, with your warrior hat on, that 12-year-old, you know, inner Pauline now coming out, wanting to change the world. I just want to give you this time to say to our listeners that go from, you know, those ecos warriors, people in sustainability, right through to brands and retailers, what you say to them to make this a reality and the fact that we do need change?
Well, we don't really have a choice, do we? Because, I mean, look at it that way. The industrial, the agricultural lens for cotton hasn't been growing. So we've been more extensively cultivating cotton, but the available agricultural land hasn't changed much. So if you think about it, that's a limit, right? You, at some point, we're not going to be able to make more fibers of cotton. Similarly, for viscose, right now, about two-thirds of our viscose comes from eco-managed forests, but one-third still comes from virgin forests, which I no need to explain you how bad this is. So similarly for viscose, if we want to keep viscose a little bit ecological, then there are also some limits in what we can produce right now. And for polyester, well, polyester comes from petrol, so it's also a limited resource. So for all of those main fibers, we have a huge environmental problem, but also a huge limit resource problem. So at some point, we're going to have to make fibers from other things than those. And the only way I can see is recycling what we already have. I mean, it's so sad that we have this huge pool of resources, 87% of used textile, that is not being used in any way, shape or form, and just literally going up in flames. So we absolutely need to react now. As you mentioned, Peter, those are technologies that take quite a long time to see the light of day. So for our hand, we're planning that if we manage to raise funds this year, then we should be able to open the first demo factory by the end of 2026, early 2027 at most, and then the full-size factory 2029, 2030 at most. So we're talking 6 years, right? So we have to act now. Otherwise, once you want the fibers, it's going to be too late. And once you hit that point that the legislation is not just encouraging with subsidies, but actually being constraining, is that how you can say it, on brands, it's going to be a problem for brands, because there's going to be a demand and offer situation, and you're going to end up paying your recycled fibers a fortune. And that would be really sad, especially when the solutions exist and are being developed right now. So please, 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 if you're a brand, contact me. My email is real simple. It's Pauline, Pauline, at Induo, Induo.sr, like friends. And please get in touch with me. I would love for you to sign a support letter or a pre-sale contract. And if you're an investor, I think this is the future of our industry and you need to get on board now.
Very good rally call there, Pauline. I think for me, the problem is that many people in the industry just don't realize to the extent of the problem. Now, every time I have a conversation with you, Pauline, like hand on heart, I learn something new. And I think that's really surprising, considering that every fashion product starts with raw materials of some kind, and most of us don't know where it comes from or what happens with it at the end of the life cycle. So there's like this huge knowledge gap as well, especially for the people that are building the products, shall we say. I just want to finish off this interview with a quick fire round of questions. So the first answer that comes to your head, are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Have you read Fashion Tech Applied yet?
I have. So you sent me the digital version and I have read some of it, not all of it.
Printed version coming to you very soon. Best advice for our listeners to be more sustainable?
Well, if you're an individual, just buy less clothes. and if you're a brand, then try to integrate as much as possible recycled material.
Last item that you recycled?
Oh, a towel from my bathroom that I just put or recycling.
Yeah, towels. For some reason, I get so many towels from my mother-in-law for some reason. She's obsessed with this. Hanging up. Which is better, mechanical or chemical recycling?
Both, because it's not a choice between the two. They're complementary. So for example, for us, we can take the waste from mechanical recycling, the fiber that are too short to be made again into textile. We can take that because it's already textile powder and recycle it with our chemical recycling process. So both need to coexist and work together to solve the problem.
A piece of advice for listeners in the corporate world wanting to begin their own startup adventure.
Just go for it. Don't think about the sacrifices. Don't think about how difficult it's going to be, because then you're never going to start. And if you do start, then you'll find solutions along the way to make it happen. And what's the worst that can happen to you? Your worst that can happen to you is you fail. And in the process, you learn a tremendous amount of things about life, yourself, your entourage, and how company works. So there's no reason not to go for it if you feel the want to start something.
Absolutely. And the worst case scenario is that you just go back to your day job and
exactly.
It's fine.
Exactly. I mean, I really believe that an entrepreneurial experience on your resume can only benefit you in every shape, way, form possible. So just go for it. Had I known everything that would go into being an entrepreneur, I probably wouldn't have done it. And I'm glad I didn't think too much about it, because I'm still absolutely thrilled I did it. So I think it's just a matter of don't overthink this, just go for it. And if you can't find solutions, then you'll go back to your day job. If you can, then it's going to be an amazing adventure and you're going to be so proud of it.
Thank you so much for your time, Pauline.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to click follow to keep up to date with the latest episodes. And if you like this episode, please give us a review. If you want us to feature a specific theme or guest, please give us a message at beyondform.io. I will see you very soon.